The end goal for our customers is that they want to be mass producing millions and millions of cartridges. So the microfluidic plastic part will be injection molded by 10 million a year, whatever quantities they're looking at, and making them for pennies. And that's absolutely fine. But obviously, yes, there's that tooling cost to set up, there's the time it takes to set up. So you need to be confident that by the time you get to that point, you know it's going to work.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Today, we're taking a little bit of an unusual trip into the world of life sciences. We're doing this because actually a fair chunk of the customers we have at Procurement Express are in the life sciences business, biotech in one sense or another. But there's a story that our guest has today is a very unusual one in that he has managed to bootstrap his life sciences business, which is sounds like a bit of an oxymoron in that you would think that in order to do something with actual physical equipment, et cetera, you would need to have a lot of backing. But we're going to talk through some of the alternate ways you can get going in a business like Paul's today without actually needing to raise venture funding, although we're going to walk through the different funding options that are out there. So Paul Marshall from Rapid Fluidics, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming along. Maybe you could just introduce yourself and give us a bit of a background of your story.
Sure. So thanks for having me here, James. I'm Paul Marshall. My background is mechanical engineering. I've got a master's in automotive engineering, not that I've ever worked in the automotive industry. Spent years designing, building equipment, working on computer-aided design software in various industries. I'm based up in Newcastle upon Tyne, northeast England, which traditionally has a large offshore support sector. So I've worked in the offshore support sector, designing 1,000-ton fabrications on the back of vessels for pipeline equipment and things like that. So I've worked in quite a range of businesses, and I've been running my own business, running Rapid Fluidics, for the last 4 years or thereabouts now. And there's an interesting step of how we went from doing trains and ATMs to doing very small pieces of plastic, which kind of got kicked into place when I applied to the IMEC-E to get chartered status. And the way you go through that process is how you're qualified with certain competences. You have to be technically good. You have to be good at project management and that kind of thing. And there was a category, which I forget the wording these days, basically talking about sustainability and things that you've done that are good. And I look back at my career at that point, which was about 15 years or so, and I really struggled to find something half qualified other than some work in renewable energy. And I thought, I've got to change things. I've got to look into an opportunity to get into something more worthwhile. And as I say, at the time, I was on a contract designing ATMs, which wasn't particularly satisfying for me. And I got introduced to a medical diagnostics company, a medical diagnostics startup here in Newcastle called Quantum DX, who were looking to develop their own in-house engineering team. And I saw that as a chance to get into life science, chance to start working with a startup, all really interesting experiences. So I jumped on the opportunity, and the rest, as I say, is history.
Very good. Okay. So interestingly enough, in your story is that before 4 years ago, I guess, you've had a traditional career working in engineering on engineering projects and for other people's companies, I guess. But had you always had this ambition to strike out on your own? Like, what was your first entrepreneurial bug that bit you? When did that happen?
Funnily enough, about 4 or 5 years ago, I never had the ambition to strike out on my own. I always had the ambition to grasp an opportunity. Having seen colleagues, friends, being in the right place at the right time, it occurred to me that if I ever was in the right place at the right time, I should absolutely go for it. And that's how, by being introduced to Quantum DX to an old friend of mine who'd been doing some work for them, I kind of thought, let's see where this one goes. Worst case, I leave and go back to what I was doing before. Best case, who knows? I knew life science was a growing industry. I looked at the sector here in the Northeast. At the time, Newcastle City Council and the University and NHS had just put in plans to create what was called at the time Science City, which is now called the Helix. So it's a new science park in the city centre on the site of the old brewery here. And I kind of thought, well, if they're investing their resources into developing the infrastructure for a growing biotech life science industry here, it's got to be a good opportunity. Let's see where this one goes. So as I say, I you know, I took the opportunity to see where it would lead me.
And that's interesting. I mean, I'm fascinated by business heroes a little bit. And so have you personally met people who took the chance and took the leap and it worked out for them?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's obviously there's people I've met over the years who have founded businesses and created them. Whether I'd describe them as a hero and or inspiration, I wouldn't necessarily say so. I think the people who've inspired me would be more some of the more successful managers that I've worked under over the years. There's obviously some good, some bad. Everybody's got stories of how they've worked with teams. And I've definitely had some very, very good managers.
What do you think marks out a good manager? What makes them, okay, hero is a controversial word, but like the best managers that you've seen, what do they do right?
I would say it's the trust and the openness and honesty. You know, trusting the team to get on with it. And that's how I try and run the team here. I basically leave them to it because I trust them to get on with it. And likewise, that goes back up the way that they trust me to keep the business going. That's absolutely the way of it. And, you know, I don't do micromanagement. I don't, you know, I'm not bothered by the finer details. I don't really care if you want to take a few hours off because the sun's shining. Great, because I know that actually you'll put the effort in on another day and everything works out well in the end.
All right. Interesting background. You were inspired, I guess, by other people who you've met who had taken opportunity. When yours came along, you grabbed it. But before we get onto that part, because make it sound easy, just grabbing the opportunity, we'll put a pin in that for a second. But let's do some basics. So there's some terminology here that I was not familiar with, and we'll start off with. So the business is called Rapid Fluidics. And maybe you could just explain what's the connection there and what actually does the company do today?
So it's based on rapid prototyping of microfluidics. And rapid prototyping is fairly obvious. You know, we do mainly 3D printing, and we can explain a bit more about that later if we need to. Microfluidics is the term that fewer people will have heard of, but actually it's fairly self-explanatory, small amounts of fluid. So our customers are developing all sorts of equipment, predominantly in life science, where they are analyzing usually or mixing, processing small amounts of fluid. And what you'll find is that, you know, a few years ago, everybody became familiar with this. You know, if you did a COVID test, when you put that horrible swab up your nose and you put the two drops onto a lateral flow device, that's a microfluidic device. If you sent it away for lab testing, for PCR testing, you know, that's a microfluidic process. And a lot of our customers are kind of taking that lab bench process that the Lighthouse Labs were able to turn over in 24, 48 hours, but they're putting that into a desktop box. So you have a cartridge, which a small amount of fluid goes in, like a lateral flow system. That cartridge goes into an electromechanical instrument that processes it and mixes it with other chemicals. It might thermocycle it, so heating and cooling it, and it eventually spits it out almost literally onto some kind of sensor, and it detects whatever it is you're looking for. So whether it's COVID, whether it's flu, whether it's an STD, they're developing systems to diagnose whatever it is that you're looking for.
Okay. So if I'm manufacturing, I guess I'm in the R&D phase of some of these machines. It takes a long time to traditionally manufacture and create a mold, I guess, and pour plastics, whatever you have to do. And this is where like a 3D printer comes in, which I guess a lot of people are familiar with.
Exactly. So with this sort of the diagnostics and point of care side of things, the end goal for our customers is that they want to be mass producing millions and millions of cartridges. So that, you know, the microfluidic plastic part will be injection molded by 10 million a year, whatever quantities they're looking at, and making them for pennies. And that's absolutely fine. But obviously, yes, there's that tooling cost to set up, there's the time it takes to set up. So you need to be confident that by the time you get to that point, you know it's going to work. And so that's where you go through the prototype iteration. And that's pretty much where this came about of while we were developing the system at Quantum, anything that we prototyped, anything we made in-house it was okay. We were CNC machining stuff in-house and it was okay, but it wasn't perfect. Anything we outsourced, it took a long time. You know, you're taking weeks to get something in, which meant if you want to go through multiple iterations of prototype, it could take months. So that's why we went into developing this process of using 3D printing, of knowing that we could create a fully enclosed component, you know, in a matter of hours.
All right, pretty good. So I guess depending on how gooey this thing is, it's going to need a bigger or smaller channel, in my scientific terming there, and that's why you need sort of the opportunity. And you were doing these in-house, and this is where you saw the opportunity. Oh, if only it was someone who had a 3D printing machine, the right type, that could get us these quickly. It's like a Goldilocks zone between mass production and bespoke piece that took so long to do. Okay, so we can't leave this topic. I mean, this sounds a little bit like what Theranos was trying to do, I guess. Are they, when you read about the machine that they were building, did that ring any bells for you, any alarm bells?
Absolutely. So, yeah, around, obviously, those of you who don't know, the Elizabeth Holmes had this idea of taking a single drop of blood, put it into a plastic chip, put that into an electromechanical reader, and it would diagnose anything, was her idea. And, you know, great idea, badly laid out. And, you know, the science for the diagnostics just wasn't there, and it all turned into a bit of a disaster and did all sorts of horrible things for entrepreneurship and so on. But, you know, the idea is there. And having worked with multiple companies developing diagnostics, I've seen that kind of attitude and that dream again and again. And 99.9% of people have it right. They have a dream and they're trying to do it right. But obviously, this, you don't always get it through. And obviously, you know, Theranos is well documented. There's the book, there's the TV series. And I've highlighted paragraphs in the book where I've seen that. I've watched the TV series and I got all excited. Like, we did that. We've, you know, that moment where a system works for the first time, fantastic, brilliant. But obviously, it went awfully wrong. With the large amount of dishonesty with the investors and the FDA.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating case, because on the one hand, you could argue that she was just kind of being an entrepreneur, which was like build a field of dreams type stuff. Maybe it was possible, maybe it's not, but you're going to act like it is and let's see if she's right.
Yeah, it's the fake it till you make it attitude, which, you know, there is an element of self-confidence that you need that as an entrepreneur. So if you're starting a business, you somehow have to persuade people that it is going to work, but actually you need their money to make it work. And that's fine in some respects. What it isn't fine with, if it's a medical device and you're actually treating patients, you can't be faking it at that point.
All right. Interesting. So then I have to ask this question as well before we get on to your story. So you're just, you know, you have a real job, as they say, which pays you reliably, and you decide, I'm going to step out and start building these rapid prototypes because you think there's a market for it. What was the pressure like from your mom, your dad, your family? Did you get support on that, or were they like, oh?
Yeah, I got, so ultimately, you know, when it all kind of came together, you know, the research at the university, the PhD carried out by our CTO, Babis Tavelikas, he'd finished that PhD. The work that I was doing at Quantum was moving on to more production. I had already decided at that point that, you know, I've been there 4.5 years, and I thought there was an opportunity to take it on my own. So I started contracting initially, just, you know, self-employed consultant contracting, as you do. And whilst going around looking for new work, going to other companies working in a similar field, I started to see the similarities of other companies developing their microfluidic systems. That's where the idea started really to pop, that actually there's a potential here, there's a demand, there's a definitely an unmet need within the industry, and we've got some technology and some knowledge here that we can make this a thing. So, as I say, initially it was just, you know, let's see what happens. And then I had a contract designing a microfluidic system for a local business. This was just as COVID, as the pandemic took off. I remember having the conversation with them, you know, okay, I'm going to design your microfluidic system for you. How do you plan on prototyping it? And they said, what do you suggest? Well, as it happens, I've got an idea. And that's where we basically formed, you know, the three of us got together. We talked about what we could do. So myself, Babis, and our third co-founder, Tom Wiltshire, we thought, you know, there's an opportunity here. Let's see where it goes. And I remember sort of sitting outside the pub with a beer and saying, let's do this. Going home and telling my wife, I've set up another business. And, you know, initially was very dubious.
Yeah, you feel about it in the morning.
Yeah. You kind of think, you know, are we doing the right thing? And to start with, it was absolutely fine. I say to start with, it's always been fine. But it was a case of, right, let's find out the size of the market. Let's see what we can do. How do we know how big the market is? Yes, it's all very well me saying, I know there are people out there, but what do we do? So we thought we need to do some market research. How do you do market research? No idea. And there was an opportunity for a grant. There's a grant advertised for cross-border communication project in a manufacturing or technological advanced situation through the European Enterprise Network. And it was, you know, €5,000, I think it was. And we applied basically saying, we've got this idea, we want to take it forward. can you help us? And we got in.
Which border are they talking about there?
So basically anywhere in Europe. So we got partnered with a marketing agency in Portugal who also actually had an understanding of additive manufacturing with 3D printing. So we had that real link there. They could understand what we were doing. So they put together a market research strategy for us and reviewed the size of the market in Europe, in the States, in Western Europe, and the UK. Sent out some questionnaires to suitable people to try and start to generate some information for us. And that came back and we kind of thought, actually, yeah, we could see there are all of these companies. These are all the points of contact of these companies who might be interested. That gave us the confidence that we could do something about this. And obviously the next stage was buy a 3D printer. And I think we qualified for another grant to help us purchase our first 3D printer. I think it was partially funded. I put a bit of money in as well. We bought our first 3D printer for a few thousand pounds.
So, I mean, the bootstrap story is emerging here quite clearly. I mean, you said you got the money, you know, you got the grants, but actually step back to that. You fractionally worked for, fractional is how people call part-time work now, fractionally worked for consulting firms as you went on that were consulting for companies that could be your customers. That's what they call customer development these days. And then you were validating as you went. So I love it because it's a very practical step. I mean, a lot of people thinking about when they're starting a business, they think, oh, I'll go to my enterprise board first, or I'll go to a startup pitch competition or a rich uncle or something first. But actually it's what a lot more pragmatic is you just go to your clients, go to your customers who's already spending money, who's spending money on me. And then they've obviously got money to spend money on me. So, and therefore just ask them what else they would like. I love it. It's very, very practical. So this led you down the, I guess, you know, okay, you got a couple of grand, 10, 15 grand from in grants, but no one else is paying you here. You have a list of people, potentially if the marketing company had done their job properly, you have a list of people who maybe could buy from you. I mean, this is all still, what, 2 or 3 months into the business, but you bought the equipment before you had your first customer, was that right?
I guess technically we did, yeah. Yeah, and we had our first customer lined up because I was working for them on a 12-month contract and we were actually still working with them to this day, yeah, a local business. So we knew we had a customer who actually wanted some product. So we bought a 3D printer. Then obviously we needed somewhere to put it. And obviously this was right in the midst of the early stage of lockdown. When we'd originally had the idea, we thought, oh yeah, we'll just set up in the university or somewhere. Couldn't get in the university, it's all closed down. Couldn't get in any of the council workspaces because they were all shut down. So we ended up renting a room in a converted church in Biker in West End of Newcastle. Sorry, East End of Newcastle, get it right way around. That meant we had a space, we had a 3D printer, I think we had a secondhand dining table and some chairs for our office, and that was it. And we made some stuff, we sold some stuff. So evenings and weekends, we'd be down there making product, selling product. And it was enough to pay the rent. It was enough to pay for the equipment and the materials. I think we got a second 3D printer fairly quickly, which is ultimately more reliable. And that kind of ticked over for maybe 6 months of just kind of just evenings and weekends down there, make stuff, sell stuff, make enough to kind of keep by and see how we can go from there. Start promoting it a little bit on LinkedIn and pushing the idea out there. No marketing strategy, no branding strategy, anything like that. Just like we can do some stuff. And it's always been important to me to have that revenue, to have some customers. I knew full well there's opportunities for further grants. I knew there's opportunities for investment to get to, but I wanted to be more secure in the business. I don't want to go out there saying, I've got this great idea. Can I have some investment, please? I wanted to say, I've got this great idea and it makes money.
So you were still doing this nights and weekends. You weren't getting paid by the sounds of it. So how long did it take before you were able to, and your team, the founders, be able to take some money to go full-time?
Quite a long time. As we built up more and more demand, especially from one particular customer and a few others, we had a large order one summer that was just going to be, you know, too time consuming to manufacture ourselves. So we thought we needed some help here. We brought in a student intern. We thought a student intern, cheap labor, fantastic. Get someone in just to operate the printers, make stuff. So we actually found a chemical engineering graduate who was looking for an internship as a way into getting a job. So he came on board and was working and making stuff for us. And that increase in productivity showed that actually we could take it a little bit further. So when the internship finished, we offered him a job, which he took, and he was with us for 2.5 years before he left to go and do a PhD. But around the time he started working, I thought, well, you know, if I've got an employee full time, I can't be part time. I think I just completed 12 months of the contract, and you know, there was an opportunity to extend it or even go permanent with that client. But I thought, no, I'm going to take that gamble. I'm not going to renew my contract. I'm going to work full time for Rapid Fluidics, really push the business. And that's what I did. And that was on zero salary for quite some time. That's where it gets interesting financially.
Okay, yeah. Now, you say zero salary, but you were getting paid. You were paying yourself out of your personal savings, right?
Well, so prior to that, obviously, I'd had the contract and I'd been paid out of that. And I'd stashed up a little bit there. I had a little bit of a cushion, not a lot. But I didn't take a salary for 12, 15 months or something when I started actually working full time.
There's a great freedom in that. I mean, that's what Rich and I did at the beginning of our business. And it's a burn the boats attitude, which means that, you know, it's A, embarrassing to go back and get a job after that. And B, you know, it really does focus the mind. You're not playing house anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah. You absolutely have to make it work. So that's, yeah, that ticked over for, you know, the best part of a year or so before things picked up to the next level. And that next level was actually the opportunity to apply for an Innovate UK grant. And this came about from a grant writer approached me and said, you've got some really cool technology here. I can get you some money. Brilliant. What's not to like here?
So at the end of this, you end up in Sandhill Road. What happened between someone coming saying, I can get you a few grand if you let me write a grant, which sounds a bit dodgy, to be honest, but anyway. What happened then?
So we went down this the Innovate UK Smart Grant route. You know, we had some ideas of technology we could develop. And so we used the grant writer and obviously paid the grant writer to apply for us. So and I think there was only a 6% success rate with smart grants at that point. And we applied, we achieved it. You know, we got funding for a £300,000 research project, which A, was going to be useful research, but also it kept us going. And the thought was we do 18 months of research paid for by Innovate UK. And in the background, I can be using those 18 months to build up the customer base more and more and more. Now, Innovate UK grants, yes, a £300,000 project, fantastic. It's actually only 70% funded and it's funded in arrears. So I needed to find 100 grand, which I didn't have lying around down the back of the sofa. I saw an opportunity for, there's a webinar about learning how to raise investment and how to put together a pitch deck. So I did a couple of local webinars about pitching. Off the back of that, I was invited to an online angel pitching event, which was with local angel investors in the north of England. And through that, I attracted my first angel investor. I did another one and found another investor. So these guys have put in their own money as angel investments and are still with me to this day. And they're fantastic. They're such good mentors for me, both on the investment and business growth side, but also the commercial and sales side as well. So it's great to have them around. They're a really good support for me. We took in a bit of other smaller investment as well. So that gave us the money to do the grant. And that's great. And we got the grant and that work started. And because we could claim for a salary, it meant I could take a salary. So great, get some money coming in. We're not actually selling the children just yet. And we can kind of tick over like that.
Well, I should stop here. I should put in for a bit because some people will be saying, hold on, I thought he was bootstrapped and now he's got angel investment. So I think it's pretty well established that anything under a couple of $100K in funding, $300,000-$400K in funding is considered to be bootstrapped because that's kind of the sort of amount of money that a single individual could scrape together with friends and family or maybe even savings if they really went for it.
Absolutely. And it was very much, it was match funding to do the research grant. So it wasn't about growth as such. It was more developing further research, which would give us capabilities for growth, but it wasn't the actual growth side of it as well. However, I got the bug for the investment side. I thought, this is quite good fun, this. You go and ask people for money and they give you money. What's that to lose? So I started looking at where I could go beyond that. And, you know, put together a slightly larger pitch, more about the growth, you know, you could call it a seed round effectively, which didn't really get anywhere other than it gave me the opportunity for my first face-to-face pitch. I went to a local VC firm and actually sat in a room with six people. So prior to that, I'd only done online pitching, which is great because you've got your 15-minute slot, you've got your spreadsheet of numbers, you've got your PowerPoint on the other screen, and you've timed to the second and you just get through it, bang, 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 done. And then you ask questions and answer questions, that's fine. My first face-to-face pitching event, sat in a room with six people with a local VC firm, kind of brought up the introductory slide about, you know, this is Rapid Fluidics, and somebody asked the question. I was like, wasn't expecting that. What the hell do I do now? We went off on a massive tangent, and I barely got through the rest of it. It went really well. We didn't take it anywhere. There was some advice given about how I could improve things, and I started thinking about, okay, what am I going to do here? And then I saw an advert, I think it was actually Tom Wilshire, I saw the advert for Ignite, which is, I think originally, I think it started off in Northern Ireland, originally it started off as, I think it was called the Ignite 100. It was an accelerator scheme to help startups grow, raise investment. Originally, there was a competition where the winner would get £100,000 investment or something. But that's kind of changed. And now it is very much a case of supporting startups, accelerate their funding round, get them aware of how to raise a lot more money and get them exposure to founders who have done that, get them exposure to, you know, environments where it's kind of easier to do and get exposure to the investors. So there's a trip to London to meet investors and founders there, but there's also a trip to the States. And ultimately, I saw a free trip to the States. Brilliant, that'll do me. There's customers in the States. So we went off to San Francisco and, you know, we went to, you know, to WeWork. We met various founders and it was really, really useful. Not the whole accelerator was really good at helping me form a pitch deck. You know, I was looking to raise £2 million and with justification for raising that amount as well. And it's funny how you soon get into the idea of talking about millions of pounds and it's just fine. It's just numbers, isn't it? But one of the groups where we were introduced to was the Sandhill Angel Group. And Sandhill Road is the home, the hub of angel investment in Silicon Valley. You know, it's where the real top-end rich people are. And the Angel Group is basically where they all club together and work out what to do. And I got invited to pitch to them on an evening pitching event. Which was done, you know, a little bit later on, a month or so later. The downside, of course, is that their evening pitching event, 6 p.m. Pacific time. I happened to be in Germany at the time, so it was 3 a.m. in Germany, and I was staying in a hotel where the only phone reception was in the bar. So there was 3 a.m. sitting in the bar with people sitting around me who were still drinking from the night before. I'd been at a trade show all day. I was exhausted trying to pitch to the richest people in California. Fair to say, it's a bit of a disaster. Didn't go down too well, but there was some really useful feedback off the back of it. It was a hell of an experience. Maybe one day I'll repeat it and do it sensibly. But you kind of, it helped me pull things together.
Well, there's a hint there as to how you actually did get going. You said you were at a trade show. So you figured out, a lot of people have an idea for a product. You had mentioned earlier that you had a list of people who could potentially buy that. And then what led you to try trade shows and how did you figure out which one to go at?
Yeah, well, obviously we've been kind of trying to grow the business through the free channels, such as, you know, we've got a website, we're using LinkedIn, we've started dabbling in Instagram and that kind of thing. But we're trying to work out how do we reach out to find more customers. And I've been to trade shows as a customer before, going around trying to find suppliers for certain technologies and so on. So I know they're a good way of actually seeing and reviewing products in one swoop. So I was aware of them. And actually we saw an ad for, it was the TCT show, which is a 3D printing show. I thought, that could be interesting. We're doing 3D printing. Maybe we should go to a 3D printing show. But then realized it's hosted in the NEC and in the hall next door is the MedTech Expo. So it's medical technology. I thought, actually, that's where we need to be. That's where we're going to find customers, the people who need support developing their medical devices. Not everyone, you know, the term medical devices can apply to a billion different objects and not everything. It's a very small proportion that actually uses microfluidics in the diagnostics and processing side of it. But that would be a good start for us. With the added advantage of actually with the TCT show next door, there's 3D print companies, so we can talk to suppliers. So we can one show for find customers, go next door and find suppliers. So it works really well.
I love the idea that you were selling them to in this hall and then you were buying in that hall. It's like, hope they don't wander over there and figure out they can buy the printer.
There is an element of that. And that first show we did, it was still during lockdown. So at the time, you know, people weren't allowed to come down from Scotland. You know, we had to wear masks all the time. But I remember standing outside the NEC the night before, absolutely bricking it. You know, full on imposter syndrome. Here I am. You know, until that point, we had a room in Newcastle. We had a couple of 3D printers. We were making stuff, selling stuff, just ticking over. All of a sudden, I'm going out there publicly to the world. People are going to come up to me. They're going to say, what's that? That's rubbish. You shouldn't be here. And I was so, so nervous.
So everyone, well, I don't know if everyone, but like, do you remember a customer that you got from this or what was the turning point? What was the term that really attracted people to come to your booth? Because I've been to a booth at some of these things before and no one pays any attention to us and it was complete whitewash. But what made a difference for you at this event?
We got a surprising amount of interest. Yeah, we certainly didn't come away from there with an order and we didn't come away from there with qualified leads as such, not at that point. But one of the things you have to bear in mind is because we're focusing very much on the prototype in the early stage development, a lot of the people we talk to, if they're on a 5-year product development cycle, 10-year product development cycle, they don't need it. They're in production, they're testing, they're so on. The main thing we want them is to raise that awareness so that next time round, when they're doing version 2, version 3, or more likely the engineers have changed jobs to a company at a different stage, if they say, we need microfluidics, there's this company I met at the NEC. So that first one was very much a testing the water, let's see what happens. Where it probably was a turning point was the following year we went back. So our second year we went back. People came up to the stand and say, I remember you from last year. I've been following you on your LinkedIn. You're doing really well. That's really interesting. We might have something to talk about. And I think it was at that show, I think I'd managed to sneak away for 48 hours. I didn't stop talking. You know, it was a constant stream of people coming to see us, which was wonderful. And I snuck away to get a coffee. And I'm in the queue for coffee, just enjoying not having to talk for a moment. And somebody taps me on the shoulder and says, can we have a word, please? I want to talk to you about a project. And it's like, again, I don't think that particular project ever went anywhere. But it's like, people really want this. There's a real demand for what we're doing. We have found that gap in the market. And we're starting to get inbound inquiries. And you think, this is the way forward.
There was market pull. There was actually something, people looking for what you had. And did you have competitors at that stage?
Yes and no. I mean, obviously, you know, the microfluidics industry is very small. It's very bespoke and very unique. And obviously, there are companies dotted around the world at the mass production and also the prototyping stage. The way it kind of works is everybody is different. Everybody's got different processes for how they manufacture, whether it's CNC machining, hot embossing, laminate buildup. There's all sorts of ways of making microfluidics, including 3D printing. And there are strengths and weaknesses to every application. There's definitely stuff that we simply can't do with 3D printing. Some of the materials we're limited in, we might not be able to get the surface finish. We might not be able to get the feature size. What we can do is do it quick. So not everybody looking for microfluidics, you know, we're not suitable for them all. And because of this, there is much more of an opportunity for collaboration between the companies you would call competitors. So if somebody comes to us and said, you know, can you do that? Well, no, but you want to go and talk to these guys over here. And it does work the other way. You know, it probably works more in terms of the mass manufacturers, the prototyping, so like a vertical recommendation and referral system rather than sideways. But it does happen. And it's really interesting talking to them. And it's got to the point, I know most of the companies in the world doing this now. I'm on first name terms with most of the management team behind them from the shows and conferences I've been to. And I get on with them all. They all can see, yes, what we're doing is really interesting, but it doesn't affect their business as such. And if anything, can support their business. There are various organizations that we're kind of in touch with about how we can collaborate. So yes, there are competitors, but it's not aggressive, if that makes sense.
Hmm. Okay, so just to sort of wrap things up a little bit then, can you tell us a bit about your ideal customer that you can serve, and then how can they get in touch with you?
Ideal customer. Originally, I thought it was the startup companies, you know, the Theranos wannabes, you know, developing diagnostics. That's where we saw ourselves as offering a really unique skill. What we've found is actually the diagnostics market has become harder for our customers to get investment in diagnostics because diagnostics isn't cool anymore. COVID's been and done. You know, they're moving on to bigger and brighter things. There's a lot more focus on AI and bioinformatics rather than the hardware side of it. So that sort of thing isn't necessarily our ideal, but equally they are a very valued customer. We've ended up with a much wider market appeal. We're doing a huge amount of work with a couple of big US pharma and research companies, you know, doing it on the drug discovery, where their processes require 3D printed geometry because it's getting so complex and they require a rapid turnaround of prototypes. And ultimately, US companies tend to be very well funded, so they're more willing to spend money on R&D. So financially, they are our ideal customer. Not necessarily the most, the technical guys we're working with are fantastic, but the admin you have to go through to deal with these big giants is a nightmare, insisting on 90-day terms, 75-day payment terms. It's horrible. I still enjoy the startups, the early stage spin-outs, the academic research, the ones who are, they've got this crazy idea, they're really, really clever, they've got this great scientific idea, and they need that engineering support to help them turn it into some kind of product. They're always great fun. And then there's everybody in between as well. You know, we're open to all suggestions. Yeah, in terms of contact, obviously, you know, the website, rapidfluidics.com. LinkedIn is a good one. We post on LinkedIn fairly regularly, once or twice a week, with just examples of what we can do. Obviously, we can't put customer data out there. So we put ideas out there. What we want is people to say, I like that and I like that. Can I have the two together, please? Yes, you can. That's the joy of 3D printing. You can easily join things together.
Very good. All right. Well, listen, if you're still listening to the podcast at this stage, thank you very much. Your reward is to be able to sign up for our newsletter, which is at procurementexpress.com/newsletter. You'll get to keep up to date with guests as they come on to the show. If you are in life sciences or biotech and you're interested in building your profile, I'd love to hear from you. We serve a number of those customers in our own newsletter and through our software. So I'm interested in finding out about this world more, to be honest. That's why Paul is here. And thanks very much, Paul, for coming along and educating me a little bit.
No worries. Thanks for your time.